More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich. Last week, New York City became the latest city in the country to host a large-scale commercial bike-sharing program. 6,000 bicycles are now available across that city at more than 300 kiosks. Organizers are still working to start a similar, smaller-scale program this year in Milwaukee. The hope is that people will be drawn to the ease of hopping on a bike and scooting across town, whether to get to a meeting or to get some exercise. It's part of a movement to return simplicity to the enterprise of bike riding, a reaction against the commodification of biking, in which spandex and sports drinks are as important as having fun. Grant Peterson is on a mission to change attitudes. His recent book is called Just Ride, A Radically Practical Guide to Riding Your Bike, and he joined us in the studio on a trip through Milwaukee. Welcome to the show.
Well, it's nice to be here, Mitch. Thanks for having me.
What is the mentality out there about bicycling that you were seeking to counter with this book?
That we should look to professional racers and even amateur racers for guidance in anything having to do with riding a bicycle. And that could be the clothing that you wear, the food that you eat, certainly the shoes that you wear. I guess that's part of clothing, and the way that you ride a bike and, you know, what is required, and even the attitude that you have when you ride a bike.
What was the tipping point when cycling went from just being an activity that people did in their leisure time to it coming with this extra layer of attitude or clothing? Or at what point do you think things changed for cycling in this country?
I think I know when it changed. I think it was when Greg LeMond started winning the top races in Europe. And I'm a huge Greg LeMond fan. And, you know, he's a hero. He's a great guy, all that kind of stuff. But before that, bicycle racing was not big in the United States. Touring had already had its day. And here was this, you know, guy, Greg LeMond, you know, winning. He won three tours to France. And manufacturers capitalized on that. And that's when the hoopla began.
And you have been a bicycle racer yourself in the past.
Yeah, I raced for about 6.5 years. I was never all that good at it. But,
but you have, instead of making that your mentality, you have crafted the concept of the unracer.
I've been more of a racer than an unracer. You know, when I quit racing, I continued riding like a racer for about 22 years. I mean, all my rides were timed and hard and long. And I didn't want to give up, you know, what I thought was my edge that I'd gained from racing. It seemed like I'd graduated from being a tourist to a racer, and I didn't want to throw in the towel. And so I rode, I'd say, the wrong way for a long time.
Well, and so when did the epiphany for you happen? When did you say, wait a minute, this is silly?
You know, there wasn't an aha moment. There was just I started going on a few rides without a firm connection to the pedal, and I started going on more sort of casual rides, but non-racing rides, just rides on trails on the hills, you know, when you camp out and stuff. And when you do that, all that racing garb is ridiculous. And you also notice, if you do it enough, that it doesn't make any difference. It really doesn't make any difference. So the way I'm dressed now, I'm ready to ride a bike.
Well, and so why do you think a guide like this was needed? Why is it necessarily a bad thing for people to take their cues from the bicycle racers, aside from the, you know, not wanting everybody to go out there and, you know, be doping?
Actually, yes, I do think it's a bad thing. I think it's a bad thing because it gets people moving in the wrong direction for bicycles. Now, whenever you wear a uniform, I mean, you can be a cop or a prostitute or whatever. If you have a uniform, you sort of take on the swagger that goes along with that uniform. And when you dress like a pro, suddenly at that point, you don't want old ladies to pass you on the road. You see people up ahead of you on the road as carrots that you've got to catch. And it sort of puts the pressure on you to ride according to the uniform.
Well, and so let's talk about some of the specific issues you address. And a very basic one, and you've alluded to this, is what cyclists wear. You know, you see people out on group rides or even by themselves, and they're wearing road racing attire. It's got bright colors. It's got ads all over it. Why do you contend this is not what they need to or maybe even ought to wear when they're out on a ride?
Let me say that, you know, however anybody gets their kicks, you know, is fine with me. You know, there's it's sort of ritual, I guess, if you're in a club to dress like the club. Same members of the, you know, the Mohicans all had mohawks, things like that. It's like the team effect. There's camaraderie and all that in there too. And I've got no problem with that. But what I do have a problem with and what I'm trying to fight, I guess, I don't know if that's the right word, but it's the idea that, oh, some guy goes into a bike shop, he wants to start riding a little bit longer, and he comes out, you know, equipped with all the funny stuff, you know, the shoes, the spandex, the Lycra, the padded shorts, everything about it. And it sends the message that this is what is required to be anything other than a casual cyclist. And when I say casual cyclist, I think casual cyclists. I think they're just as high on the ladder as anybody else, but you do not need to dress like that. You don't need to dress like that. And that doesn't mean that every garment in your wardrobe is great for cycling, but you know, most casual clothing is. Most casual clothing is.
Well, right. So let me ask that. If you're the guy that goes into the cycle shop and decides he wants to he or she wants to get into cycling, what are some of the more practical things that that they can be wearing? You know, if not their business suit, you know, what makes a good cycling wardrobe?
For the last probably 10 years, 99%+ of my rides, all of my miles, I've worn Teva sandals. They're just sandals. I use platform pedals, just double-sided like BMX pedals. I wear light nylon or cotton shorts, nothing with a big seam in them. I wear whatever socks I happen to have on. T-shirts, long-sleeve shirts, they can be loose. You don't need a tight shirt, and that's about it.
You kind of get into the idea, the notion that people who say that they want to have fabric that breathes, that there's really no such thing.
I don't think rainwear really breathes. I think, you know, like a light cotton shirt, that'll breathe. Cotton wool, just any, you know, the clothes that you have on now. It looks like you've got a cotton T-shirt on underneath a long sleeve plaid. Nice shirt, by the way, button-down cotton shirt, and that is perfectly good. And this idea that cotton is going to get wet and it's going to give you hypothermia or you'll get the chills because it won't dry out fast, you know, what kind of ride are we talking about? Are we talking about a cold weather ride of 5 or 6 hours? Then wear wool, wear some synthetic whatever, dry fast clothing, wicking, stinky fabric that you want. But, you know, how many rides are like that? And is that even a healthy kind of ride? And I guess that would be another topic. But certainly, I think, you know, most people on a ride an hour or two, you can wear whatever you got going.
Well, and the other really touchy subject you get into is the wisdom of wearing a helmet. And this is something that we're led to believe is a given, that helmets equal safety. Why is that not necessarily the case?
It's not necessarily the case, I think, for two reasons. The first reason is that the helmets are not as protective as you would like them to be. I mean, bicycle helmet manufacturers cannot put all that much protection into 7 or 8 ounces. One time there was a 5-ounce helmet. You just can't do that. It's styrofoam and some sort of a hard shell to distribute the load. You can't put that much protection into a helmet that cyclists are going to buy. And yet, the helmet is a safety item. It's for protection. So you put it on, you think you're protected. Whenever you wear a protective garment of any kind, you tend to engage in behaviors that you would not do without it. That is the whole point. And if the protection is complete, if it's thorough, complete protection, hey, everything is good. But in the case of the bicycle helmet, when it's not as protective and you ride a little bit more risky because of it, then it's not so good. It's sort of like a bulletproof vest with a bunch of gaps in it or something like that.
Well, and I think you're right that the ideal thing to do is to wear a helmet and then forget you have it on.
That's right. Anytime I'm about to hit my head, I'd rather have a helmet on. And I'm not against helmets. I'm not against helmets. I am against, I guess, the idea that they are as protective as you would like them to be. Wear the helmet, pretend you don't have it on, whatever.
Let's talk about the bikes themselves, and you get into some really technical issues later on in this. But there's a very basic message that you write very early on in this book, and that is most bikes have way more gears than people need. Why would you contend that really, I think you write that 8 gears are sufficient for what most people are doing?
You know, I don't think the surplus of gears is one of the top evils in bikedom or anything like that. But it's easy enough to make the case that 8 gears is enough. I'll count them out right now. You need a really, really high gear for pedaling downhills, a regular high gear for pedaling with a tailwind, medium high gear, medium low gear, super low gear, and ultra, ultra, supremely low gear, and that is 8. And I would, you know, I challenge anybody to come up with how are you going to add more than that? You know, but it's another influence that came from racers. Racers used to ride 10-speed bikes, mathematically 10-speed, meaning two rings in the front and 5 cogs in the back. And now they're mathematically 30 speeds and they're going to even more. And so when Joe Blow goes out to buy a bike, he looks at what the racers are riding, and bike shops tend to do that too. And then, well, they're the pros. They must know the best. So I'm going to get the same kind of thing. And then you end up with all kinds of gears. Now, for a racer, there are benefits to having smaller increments between gears. If you aren't racing, fewer benefits. Just pedal a little bit faster, pedal a little bit harder, bridge the gap, 8's enough. My bike has 27, but that's just the way it came.
Well, and I think the point you also make is that a lot of what you do can be compensated by simply shifting your body weight in different ways rather than needing mechanical assistance.
Yeah, with all the gears and with shifting systems that they have on bikes and the way that people are told to ride them, they are encouraged to shift more often. You know, there's this notion that there's a dream pedaling cadence or optimum efficiency. You want to be pedaling between, I don't know, 90 and 105 RPMs. And for racing, that makes sense. For anyone who doesn't race, it is not a benefit at all. It doesn't make sense. It's not just that you won't benefit as much as a racer will because you aren't racing, so it doesn't matter for you. It is purely not a benefit at all. I'd say it's even a drawback. I'd say slow down your cadence, pedal a little bit higher gear, whatever.
There are a lot of bicyclists who make the case for always wanting to ride in traffic and that bicycles are part of the road and they try to stay off of bike paths when they can. You write that you try to stay on bike paths while you can. What's the argument in support of bike paths as opposed to always riding in traffic?
I think bicycles are traffic, and I think bicycles ought to be accommodated far more than they are. But if I've got a choice between, you know, mixing it up with Detroit Iron and mixing it up with strollers and rollerbladers, I'd rather do that. So I take bike paths because I know I trust myself not to hit anybody, and I know I'm not going to get killed by a rollerblader.
So what do you think is at stake here? Why is it important to break down some of these myths? Do you think are there people out there that might be bicyclists if not for them?
If you are enjoying riding racerly, you know, if you enjoy the costume, the effort and all that, then I think it's just fine. But, you know, a lot of people, like a typical adult cyclist, gets into bikes again, you know, and is – I'll just say it's a guy, but it's with women too. But in his 30s or something, maybe he's gaining a little bit of weight. He doesn't want to go swimming. He doesn't want to swim. You know, it's not convenient to swim, and it's a whole other world.
You can't swim to work.
You can't swim to work. Swimming is out. Running is out for a lot of people. A lot of people are too heavy to run. It's miserable to run. I mean, for a lot of people it is. And so bikes are natural. You know, they get into a style of riding that I think is – it doesn't give them what they want. You know, people want to lose weight. People want to be healthy and lose weight. And as you age, you know, you don't want to be the fat old guy. And so they get into a racer style of riding because they see that racers are skinny and they think that they're going to get skinny too. It doesn't work that way. You cannot ride off weight if the only change is exercise. You're just building up a bigger appetite and eating more food. And then the kinds of foods that you're encouraged to eat, carbohydrates, just make you fat anyway. So it doesn't work that way, and I know that.
So in the end, it's really about changing your lifestyle and not necessarily conforming to any one image of what a bicyclist should be.
I think that a bicycle should be fun, and I think it should be transportation, recreation. It can be a good way to see the country if you want to go and do that by bicycle. But just make it fun. Don't push yourself. Don't think that you can whip yourself into shape. Don't take this wonderful child's toy, even if it's several thousand dollars, it's still a toy. If you are not a pro, it's a toy. Don't turn it into a torture device. Don't turn it into a piece of fitness equipment. Go to the gym for that. I mean, that's a dreadful way to ride a bike.
Grant Peterson, thanks so much.
Well, thank you, Mitch.
Grant Peterson's book is called Just Ride, A Radically Practical Guide to Riding Your Bike, published by Workman. He lives in California, where he is the founder and owner of Rivendell Bicycle Works, which makes steel bike frames. That's all for the Wednesday edition of Lake Effect. If you'd like to listen back to any of today's segments or any of our previous shows in recent memory, you can check out our archives at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. You can also learn how to subscribe to our podcast and have our entire show delivered automatically to your mobile device and take us wherever you go, even if it's on a bicycle. It's all online at wuwm.com. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for being with us today. I sure hope you'll tune in again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We are NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.